Started. This is a meeting of the Title Setting Review Board pursuant to Article 40 of Title I, Colorado Revised Statutes. The date is May 30th, 2008. The time is 8:38 a.m. We're meeting in the Secretary of State's Blue Spruce Conference Room, 1700 Broadway, Suite 270, Denver, Colorado. The Title Setting Board today consists of the following. My name is Bill Hobbs. I'm Deputy Secretary of State, representing Secretary of State Mike Kaufman. To my left is Dan Carton, Deputy Director of the Office of Legislative Legal Services, who is the designee of the Director of the Office of Legislative Legal Services, Charlie Pike. To my right is Dan Domenico, Solicitor General, who is the designee or the representative of Attorney General John Southers. To my far left is Maury Kanizer, Deputy Attorney General, who represents the Title Board. To my far right is Ceci Gomez of the Secretary of State's office. There are sign-up sheets for anybody who wishes to testify on the items today. the meeting is recorded and broadcast over the Internet. We have two agenda items today. Both of these are before us on motions for rehearing. Number 123 and number 124. If there's no objection, I'd like to take these together. They are alternative versions of, I think, basically the same proposal, same proponents, essentially the same motion for rehearing. So with that, I will turn it over to Mr. Gessler to speak on behalf of the motion for rehearing.
Thank you, Mr. Hobbs. For the record, my name is Scott Gessler. I represent Mr. Cole, who's the protester in this matter. And we have no objection to consolidating 123 and 124 because I think the arguments are identical. What I've handed out to the proponents as well as each member of the Title Board is a packet of information. And that contains a copy of the review and comment memo for item number 123, a copy of a transcript for the review and comment hearing for number 123, a copy of the transcript for the initial hearing before the board for 123, contains a copy of the review and comment memo for 124, the review and comment memo hearing transcript for 124, and the original Title Board hearing for 124. And then finally, because I'll be referencing it, a copy of the case in re title ballot title submission clause for 2007-2008, number 64. So I hope both the proponents and each member of the board actually do have all that information in that packet. And if there aren't any questions, I'll just proceed.
Go ahead.
My first argument and first argument on the rehearing here has to do with the jurisdictional argument. And basically, the argument here is that the changes to the memorandum were not, first of all, that they were substantive change, and secondly, they were not in response to a question or comment by Office of Legislative Legal Services or Legislative Council. And basically, just to go through exactly what it was, the original version of this initiative, this I think applies for 123 and 124, initiative singular. subsection 2 said this definition shall, the last sentence, prevail over any conflicting definition of labor organization in Article 18 of this, I'm sorry, it currently says in Article 18 of this Constitution. Originally, it said in Article 28 of this Constitution, as including any provision adopted at the 2008 general election, regardless of the number of votes received by this or any other such amendment. So first of all, that is a substantive change, and I understand that the proponents characterize that as a typographical error. But if you look at Article 28, it directly discusses, it directly regulates labor organizations. It's the campaign finance and reform initiative that was adopted in 2002. So So the term labor organization has direct relevance to Article 28. And in fact, when we first looked at this, we were certainly taken aback by the approach that the proponents took, but also the fact that this is this changed the definition of labor organization in Article 28, and then changed by changing the definitions. It effectively exempted certain types of organizations that traditionally would be considered labor organizations from campaign finance regulations. So that was a broad change. And then in comparison, we looked at Article 18 and ran a word search. Article 18 of the Constitution is entitled miscellaneous. It's sort of a catch-all area. And the term labor organization does not show up there at all. And so it was absolutely reasonable to look at how this affected Article 28, because Article 28 has the term labor organization, and Article 18 doesn't use the term labor organization at all. So it only makes sense. So I think that, and plus, saying Article 28 versus Article 18 is a big difference. It's not a matter of simply a misspelled word or an improperly placed comma. This fundamentally changes the meaning of what this is, of what this provision is, and as a result, it's a substantive change. I mean, when you change the meaning of something, that's a substantive change. A typographical change is an error in typing that doesn't effectively change the substantive meaning of something. I argue a substantive change.
A typo can certainly change the substantive. It can be both, right? I mean, if you wrote a sentence that says the income tax rate shall be 50%, and you meant to hit 10% or 4%, I mean, that's both a typo and a substantive change, right? I mean, because it changes the meaning of something doesn't mean it's not a typo.
I would accept that characterization, that a substantive change can also be a typographical. Right. And here, I mean, it doesn't detract from the argument that here this is a substantive change. Whatever the cause of the substantive change, it's a substantive change. So I guess under that reason, we entirely disagree. So the first point is that this is a substantive change. Now the second point is it needs to be under 1-40-105 2. It basically needs to be an amendment has to be in direct response to the comments of the directors of the Legislative Legal Council and the Office of Legislative Legal Services. So basically, that has a couple points to it. First of all, it has to be a direct response. Secondly, it has to be in response to the comments. Now, if you look at the review and comment memo itself, for item 123, this contains several sections. One is an introduction. Two is the recitation of the purposes. Three is clearly labeled comments and questions. These are the comments and questions. There's sort of two components to the reasoning here. First of all, the comments and questions are the written comments and questions that are presented to the proponents. They're not what happens verbally at the hearing. The hearing is to explain the comments and questions. Comments and questions are the written comments and questions. And I think that has to be the instance if you look at the grounding of the text of 1-40-105. Basically, it says no later than, and I'm looking at 1-40-105, subsection 1 in the middle of it. It says no later than 2 weeks after the date of submission of the original draft, unless it is withdrawn by the proponents, the directors of the Legislative Council and Office of Legislative Legal Services, or their designees, shall render their comments to the proponents of the petition concerning format or contents of the petition at a meeting open to the public. Where appropriate, and this is the key language, such format or contents where appropriate, such comments shall also contain suggested editorial changes to promote compliance with the plain language provision of this section. I'm sorry, that's not the critical point. This is the critical point. except with the permission of the proponents, the comments shall not be disclosed to any person other than the proponents prior to the public meeting with the proponents of the petition. So you have comments that are not disclosed until the public meeting. And at the public meeting, the comments are disclosed. So the comments are something that can be given to the proponents in advance and not disclosed to the public. In other words, the comments are the written comments here. And so that's what the comments are. It's not, and I would submit from several points, not only the literal language, but from a policy standpoint, it's not sort of a broad-reaching analytical discussion during a hearing, and whatever comes up during the hearing happens to be a comment. The comments are grounded in the writing because of the purposes behind this, the literal language that the comments are something that are rendered and are not disclosed in advance until the public hearing. So the public hearing is different. And thirdly, you know, it provides a very clear and clean basis for to determine what this title board's jurisdiction is. Not an elastic definition, but it's a relatively solid.
Well, doesn't the policy reasoning behind the requirement that changes be made in response to comments actually cut against interpreting it in that way, in that I would think that the only justification for requiring that comments, that changes be in response to comments, is that it allows for, at the hearing, opponents or the public or other interested people to understand why changes are being made. And if the written comments are confidential and they aren't disclosed until the hearing, then how does that match up with the reasoning behind requiring changes to be related to something brought up by during the process or in relation to comments or questions?
Well, because the comments, I think, have more than simply that purpose to provide notice to the public in the hearing. I think the comments also are the considered, and this is the purpose of the whole review and comment, it's the considered analysis that Legislative Legal Services and Legislative Council believe that needs to be taken into consideration in either revising or reviewing the statute. It's not a give and take back and forth, whatever the proponents choose to come up and the Legislative Council says, well, gee, that's a good comment or something along those lines off the cuff, which is essentially what happened here. I mean, what this is for someone to go back and study this and say, okay, look, based upon this, these are the changes that we suggest or these are our comments based upon a well-considered analysis of this rather than sort of an off-the-cuff give and take. So there's really more than, certainly the public needs to have notice of what's going on, but the actual purpose of the review and comment, I think, is to create a better initiative, not to allow proponents sort of willy-nilly amend their initiative as things go forward, but only in direct response to well-considered analysis here. And that's what the written review and comments are, sort of this well-considered analysis. That's the purpose for the review and comments. Certainly a secondary purpose is to provide the public notice. That's the purpose of the public hearing. But the purpose of the review and comments is to give the proponents input into what's going on. Otherwise, there's no need to even have a direct response to a comment. I mean, that simply removes, I think your argument removes it from the moorings of the purpose. Basically, under your reasoning, as long as the public has notice of why a change is being made, it doesn't matter. So why would it even be necessary to be in direct response? The reason it's necessary to be in direct response to a comment is because of this well-considered analytical approach, not merely for notice. Otherwise, there would be no need for it to be in response to a comment. Could be simply provide notice to the public that we're going to be doing this rather than response to a comment.
Mr. Gessler, I'm just not sure I'm entirely following. It sounds like you're saying that the meeting itself is a mere formality, that the written comments have been delivered to proponents. I'm not sure what you picture happening at the meeting. I mean, I guess the memo is disclosed publicly. The proponents may comment or in response, but are not required to. I think the practice might be that staff might read the questions, but I'm not sure that there's any point, because if that's the limit, the memo kind of speaks for itself. If that's the limit of the discussion, I think I hear you saying there cannot be a dialogue based on those written comments that goes beyond, that leads beyond the comments on paper. Is that correct?
Not entirely. What I would say is the review and comment session is not a mere formality. I mean, it certainly performs two important roles. One is to provide additional guidance or give and take to the extent a proponent doesn't understand a comment. Okay, for example, a comment may say, you've not used the proper title structure in this particular instance. And would you consider changing it along these lines? And maybe the along these lines is somewhat incomplete, and a proponent may say, well, no problem, I'll change it along those lines. Should I put my period here or my semicolon here? And, I mean, that draws from my personal experience. But if you look at the transcript, let me finish that thought. The other purpose, obviously, is to provide the public notice of the comments. That's why they're, that's why you have the public hearing, and that's when the review and comments are released at the public hearing, so that that can be public. So it certainly fulfills those two purposes, okay? But the purpose of the public hearing is a little bit different than the purposes of the review and comments themselves, or questions and comments. And if you look at page 2 of the transcript for the hearing, the initial hearing, towards the bottom, line 23, it says the purpose of the and this is read by OLS and OCS, OLC. Says the purpose of the review and comment requirement is to help proponents arrive at language that will accomplish their intent and to avail public of knowledge of the contents of the proposal. So there's two purposes right there, and I guess this goes back to my response to Mr. Domenico. One of the purposes is to help the proponents arrive at language that accomplishes their intent. And that's based upon a well-considered analysis of the text itself. Okay, those are the review and comments. And then the hearing is on the next paragraph. If you continue in that same paragraph, line 4 on page 3, it says, we hope that the statements and questions contained in this memorandum will provide a basis for discussion and understanding of your proposal. So it's the memorandum itself. It forms the basis as to what needs to be directly responded to.
Well, it said a discussion, though. But it sounds like that discussion is kind of irrelevant if it goes beyond the written comments of the staff.
That's correct. I think the discussion may be relevant for certain other things, but I think the discussion, if it goes beyond these direct comments, the questions and comments in here, it's irrelevant for making changes.
Well, and you might be about to, well, I'm sure we are going to get into the specifics here a little bit, but at least theoretically it seems to me that it's just hard to draw a fine line here in that a comment might say the form of your citation to Article 28 is, we would suggest, a standard form of citation. That could be the written comment. The proponents may come to the meeting and say, you know, we looked it up in response because you made the comment about the form of the citation, and we discovered that that was a mistake, that we should have said Article 18 instead of Article 28. So, we're gonna correct that typographical error. Then the staff might say, well, then that raises other questions. But you're saying they can't raise other questions.
And I think your hypothetical explains exactly why my approach is correct. First of all, the language is direct response. It's not response. Now, I understand we can have arguments as to what's direct or not. But if they say, look, the format is incorrect, and the proponents turn around and say, oh, you're right, the format is incorrect, and by the way, we used 10 rather than 50, that's not formatting. That goes to substance. That's not whether it should be spelled F-I-V-E versus the numeral 5. Okay, so it has to be in direct response. And secondly, I would argue that, I mean, you prefaced your comments, Mr. Hobbs, by saying there has to be, it's very difficult to draw a clear line here. No, it's not. And the reason why it's not difficult to draw a clear line is because we have written memorandum that has a section that says questions and comments. And so we go based upon the written text. And with respect to your approach, that's exactly why I think it's wrong. But we'll continue with your hypothetical. The proponents say, no, it should be this article rather than that article. And then the discussion turns into a lot of substantive questions about Article 18 versus Article 28. Well, that sort of defeats the purpose. Yes, it's interesting to have that broad-ranging discussion, but these should be well-considered, researched, analyzed comments and questions to an initiative. They shouldn't be off-the-cuff discussions of what different policy options there are, and by the way, this brings up an idea here, and perhaps you might want to do that. I mean, I think the purpose here is you give the OLLS and 2 weeks to analyze this with subject matter experts who can look at it and render something in writing, because that's the way good laws are made, in writing and review comments. And that provides clarity, and it helps us have lines and boundaries and understand what we are and not supposed to do. That's why there's a written text. So I think your hypothetical actually illustrates the dangers of going down that road. And along those dangers, it certainly, and I argument asked before the board, opens it up to manipulation. I'm certainly not a legislator. But what I am saying is that it allows a proponent to say, gee, I should have added a section here. So I'll bootstrap that into some comment and say, no, that's not really my purpose, or what I really meant to say is this, and then hopefully draw additional questions or draw the people going through the review comment memo into a discussion on this subject. I now have my substantive comments and questions and can change this and can change my initiative around in a major fashion. So it becomes ungrounded and unmoored from the written text and the consideration provided by staff.
Well, we had a real-world situation at the last meeting of the title board on May 21st that this reminds me of, where we did have a proponent that had made a number of changes after the review and comment hearing, adding a number of sections. I don't remember the number, but it dealt with the creation of a rail authority, added a number of sections, and the proponent, it was not obvious that those were in response to the written comments, and the proponent said, I didn't know I had to bring a transcript, but yes, this was all part of the discussion that was had in the public meeting. In that case, it is troublesome in that it's hard to know whether the changes were in direct response. Part of what tipped the issue in favor of not setting a title in my mind was that the changes were so numerous and substantial that it really did seem like there needed to be a more complete review and comment. Now, I guess if by analogy I could argue that the same thing would apply here, that using my hypothetical, that if in the course of the discussion proponent said, we noticed that we made a typographical error and this really was supposed to be Article 18, the staff might say, oh, well, that might raise new questions that we had not thought of because we thought you actually meant Article 28. So I think that's what you're arguing, is that that the review and comment process is not well served if that can be done orally. In other words, the staff may not be prepared to ask the right questions and make the right comments when they flow from kind of an off-the-cuff discussion like that.
And I'd argue that's exactly the case here. For example, and we'll get into this beyond the jurisdictional argument, Article 28 has the definition of labor organization. We can analyze and we can understand sort of what the results are of changing this or creating this definition for labor organization. this non-definition of labor organization, however you characterize it. But this initiative also purports to change all, to govern all definitions in Article 18. And that begins a host, and I understand, and we'll talk about the fact that this is meant to be a direct preemptive strike on Amendment 47. But the language is not limited to Amendment 47. When you use the term all definitions, and it's in something called miscellaneous, the article itself, well, how does that govern if someone later comes up and says, well, now I've got something for labor organizations, which maybe isn't connected to conditions of employment, has nothing to do with that subject, but instead has a different subject and now is in conflict with this definition of labor organization. How does that play out? Those are valid opportunities and valid questions, substantive questions, but by calling this a typo, glossing over it, moving into article and moving into the remainder, it does not give the staff adequate time or to even consider the ramifications of that. And I think that's very troubling. Sit down. Does anyone have questions on that?
Mr. Carton?
No, I'll wait.
Okay. So are you going to, I don't know, Mr. Gessler, I thought maybe you would just go ahead and proceed with your other arguments, but I don't mind breaking them up one by one. It's up to the board and the participants. So
I'm sorry, perhaps I left in a flourish of drama. Yeah. Whatever the board prefers, I'm happy to move on or allow Mr. Gruskin to respond to the jurisdictional argument.
I mean, we can do a kind of a back and forth on each issue, and it keeps it a little fresher.
That's fine.
I don't know. Okay. And then maybe Mr. Gruskin will hear from him on this particular issue.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the board. Mark Gruskin, appearing for the proponents. The argument about the jurisdictional issue, I think, can be addressed fairly quickly. The Supreme Court has said that in a case, the citation which I don't recall, the Administrative Procedures Act doesn't apply to the in this process, your process included, because these are public forums. They're more legislative, and I suppose we can argue whether or not legislation is well considered or not, but there's a lot of off-the-cuff activity in a legislative hearing. Whether this was off-the-cuff or not, I suppose, is open to question. However, if you take a look at the final draft of the measure as submitted in the packet, Section 1 states Article 18 of the Constitution is amended by blah, 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 blah. That's how that always read. That particular reference was never Article 28. The staff understood that. So there was an inherent conflict where the introduction talks about Article 18 and then Subsection 2 of Section 17 talks about Article 28. So I think that was pretty clear. Nonetheless, there were at least two times when this issue came up. In the transcript that Mr. Gessler provided you of the May 9th hearing, on page 4, there was a summary of purposes and there was a reference to Subsection 2 and Article 28. And I admitted that it was my typo because the intention was that it would be Article 18, and then I said, your memo accurately reflects that typographical error, but that's something we'd like to correct, obviously, since it would be inherently contradictory. So I'm assuming you agree that would be a technical correction. Mr. Pogue nods head. Ms. Forrestal, agreed. Mr. Pogue, agreed. Then the issue does come up again on pages 6 and 7 of the transcript in response to one of the technical questions. Ms. Forrestal on page 6, line 23, on line 16 for proper citation format and to indicate that Article 28 is within the Colorado Constitution, would the proponents consider adding, quote, of this Constitution, end quote, after, quote, Article 18, end quote, question mark. Mr. Gruskin, well, as I indicated earlier, we'll make it Article 18. we'll make it of this Constitution, and that is on line 16. So it comes up in response to a question. If you take a look at the legislative staff memo, the staff wasn't confused. They didn't think this was a campaign finance measure. Campaign finance doesn't come up in the context here. As a matter of fact, they specifically raise under their substantive question number 4 whether or not this is an appropriate or permissible way in which to have ballot measures that interact with one another on the same ballot. Obviously, that's the case here. So they understood that this wasn't about issue. And in fact, I think if you take a look at the transcripts, you'll find no reference to Article 28 at all, other than that typographical error. There was no consideration of the issue raised. Finally, if you can't have give and take, and if you can't clarify internal contradictions, you're necessarily limiting the ability of proponents who don't have the benefit of having two houses and two committee hearings and two full floor debates to have a give and take that leads to clarification. And that's what happened here.
Well, but I mean, doesn't 140.105 actually provide for that kind of give and take? But what it says is that if there's a substantial amendment made to the petition that's not in direct response to the comments, the way you have that give and take is then to resubmit it to the directors for comment, basically starting over. I mean, and so to me, I mean, there is something, I think, to Mr. Gessler's point that the staff, that there's a reason for this process, and part of it is for the staff to be able to read it and provide comments and questions based on what it says. And the hard part for us is we're sort of left guessing whether if it had originally said 18 rather than 28, there would have been any different questions. And I don't know how we answer that question, but I guess that sentence in 140.105.2 leaves me with two questions only. One is this a substantial amendment? If it's not, then we can move on. And then the other question is the amendment in direct response to the comments? And again, if it is, we can move on. But if either of those, well, I guess if both of those apply, if it's substantial and it's not in direct response, then doesn't the statute require it to be resubmitted to the directors? And so aren't those the two questions we should be focusing on, I guess?
Absolutely, Mr. President. You're absolutely right.
And all right.
I would suggest to you it's not a substantial change because it parallels the introduction, it parallels the entire conversation, and it parallels the entire analysis provided to provided by staff. And second issue was whether it's a major change.
Well, the two issues, as I see it in there, are substantial amendment or direct response.
Right. And frankly, if the proponents had come up with a definition of corporation or a definition of employer or a definition of something that was well outside the bounds and not addressed in the memo and not addressed in the give and take, then that would be appropriate. But in actually last Friday in the Supreme Court's decision on number 57, it specifically cited both the technical and the substantive questions as sufficient basis for making a change by proponents. I think that both those questions are the right questions to ask. Both those questions are answered here. This is an insubstantial change. It's a non-material change, except to the extent that it clarifies. I mean, think about the problem if it doesn't get clarified. And secondly, it's in direct response to issues raised by or comments made by the staff. I don't think that, I mean, to use a litigation analogy, I don't think that you have to have a leading question in order for there for that to be in direct response. The whole purpose of these hearings is so that there can be some initial public hearing of the matter. People can attend them, and at that point, they get the memo, as Mr. Gessler points out. They don't get it before. They're not confused. There's no disadvantage to the public. And they listen on the Internet if they want to. If you partake in that process, in either in person or on the Internet, then you are part of, or at least privy to, the interchange about the measure. That's the idea. That kicks off the whole process. And so I think both your questions are absolutely the right ones, Mr. Penico. Both of them are answered, I think, fairly easily, that the proponents acted within the statute by making clarification.
It is curious to me that, I mean, that there were not questions about this. I mean, and maybe this is doesn't lead anywhere, but given that the proposal before the review and comment stage was saying that the definition of labor organization prevails over anything else, any definition in Article 28, and knowing that that definition in this measure is basically saying labor organization means something other than a labor organization, I mean, that's a pretty dramatic effect on Article 28.
Well, actually, I don't think labor organization is defined in Article 28. I was just looking at it. The term is used in there, but I don't think there's actually a definition unless I missed it.
That's correct. There is no definition.
Yeah, and so it's kind of an odd, either way, whether it's referring to 18 or 28, it's kind of odd without sort of hard to figure out what's going on.
I mean, that's a good point. I think staff might have raised a question about even, we note that there's no definition of labor organization in Article 28. We're unclear as to your intention in saying that in Article 28, labor organization means something other than a labor organization. You know,
but there's also no definition in Article 18, and so, right. Yet.
And yet I can sort of see, even though I don't know why right off the staff didn't raise a question about the reference to Article 28 and the impact on Article 28, I can see that, you know, when a change is made so that instead of referring to Article 28, subsection 2 of the proposal refers to Article 18, that there's actually less, I'm not quite sure how to articulate this, less reason to comment on that. In that there's no, it's not quite so notable in that it's the same problem in that there's no definition in Article 18 either. But I'm not sure that staff would have any comments about the measure if it had simply referred to Article 18 consistently.
I think the problem is there's not really any hint in the memo or anywhere else that I've seen that the staff was asking questions based on it being amendment or Article 28. That there's no hint that it was important to them that it referred to 28. But that doesn't quite answer the question of whether it would have been important to them if it had said 18 originally, if they would have asked different questions. And so the it's still the question is, to me, I don't actually think this is an indirect response to the comments of the directors. I think the example we sort of used came up with together, that if the question was if the question or comment was, do you really would you like to put your 50% in written numbers rather than spelled out words, and they said, whoa, yes, and in addition, what we really meant to say was 10%. That, to me, isn't a direct response. And that's sort of similar to what went on here. And at most, I mean, it was almost more that they just brought up a question having to do with that part of the measure, and Mr. Gruskin realized he'd made a typo. On the other hand, the question of whether it's substantial is different to me. And the language is substantial, not substantive, which I think makes a bit of a difference. I don't know whether it should or not, but to me, I think it does. I probably would agree that this is substantive in the sense that it changes, well, assuming that there's also another definition in 18, eventually, that this would seeks to supersede, then that is a substantive change. If not, given that currently there's no definition of labor organization in either 18 or 28, I'm not sure it would be substantive anyway.
May I just make one correction? It's not that there's a slight difference between 18 and 28. There's no usage in 18 of labor organization.
Right, but
not only is there no definition, but there's no usage. Article 28 does use the term extensively, labor organization. It does not contain a definition.
Right, I understand that, but and that's why it makes sense to me what you say, that it wouldn't be shocking, and I actually don't necessarily think that, as it was originally written, the intro necessarily conflicted with the text. You could put in the miscellaneous section of the Constitution a definition that refers to another section, it seems to me. And so it's not, I don't quite agree that it's contradictory, as Mr. Gruskin said, inherently contradictory. But what it says is it'll prevail over any conflicting definition of labor organization in whichever article. And there's no definition in any article yet. So, I mean, the question is, to me, not, I guess, where I'm leaning is interpreting the statute, the use of substantial amendment, not to mean an amendment that has some substantive effect on the law. Because if it doesn't have a substantive effect, then it really is just a pure typo. It has to significantly change what the law would do internally. It has to change the amendment itself, the measure itself, substantially. And this one, I'm not sure it does that.
And I think that's a really good point. I am looking at, I mean, the notes of the one case that I can find that may speak to this, a 1992 case, In Re Limited Gaming, 830 P. 2nd, 963, and there the court found that the measure as filed with the Secretary of State, and I think this is a quote, differs so substantially, keyword being substantially, differs so substantially from the language submitted for review and comment that the revised version in effect constitutes a new proposal requiring resubmission for review and comment.
May I ask the pin site on that?
830 P. 2nd at 966.
Thank you.
If my notes are correct. And I'm not sure I have an accurate quote there, but it seemed like in that particular case, the court was emphasizing that there was a substantial, not substantive, but substantial change to the measure, and that it in effect constituted a new proposal. Now, I don't know that that's say that the court would not find a problem with something that was a substantial change that didn't amount to effectively a new proposal. I mean, that's a pretty high standard to meet, given the purpose of review and comment, that you could. I wouldn't argue that this case means that as long as you don't rewrite the proposal, you can make substantial changes and not submit for review and comment. But it does seem like it's not so much a question of substantive change, but substantial change.
And I guess the difficulty is, if in fact, I forget what this is in response to, but if it were already on the books, if Article 18 already had a definition of labor organization in it, and then this happened, someone came in and tried to do this, then I really would think that you're making a substantial change to what would happen, because Article 28, if you're just saying, well, we're defining it for Article 28, then you're not accomplishing the same thing. The difficulty is that's not on the books yet, and so neither section has a change or has a definition that would be superseded. And in that sense, the measure, well, I mean, I think this is a close call.
Mr. Garden.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think that Mr. Gessler has made a very interesting argument here. Here's kind of where I'm coming at this from. I'm not sure we can speculate on why staff did or did not include certain questions in the comment memo. But I think the fact that there weren't questions in the memo that tied into Article 28 indicate to me that this amendment isn't a substantial amendment. If there had been questions, for example, in the memo that said the proponents have said this definition shall prevail over Article 28 of labor organization, there's no definition of labor organization, what do the proponents intend here? If there had been a question about the definition of person in Article 28, which includes a labor organization, for example, a question that said, is this intended to modify the definition of person? Political committee, the definition in Article 28 provides that all political committees established, financed, maintained, or controlled by a single labor organization. If there had been a question that said, how does this impact that definition? I think I would have more heartburn over the fact that the proponents would come and then change the section of the article of the Constitution within which this provision is ultimately intended to be located than I do right now, and may feel as though it were more of a substantial amendment than it is. But the fact that the memo did not include any questions on that, at least for me, kind of proves up that it's not a substantial amendment. And secondly, I do think, even if it is, that it's in response to the comments. And I look at question under the purposes, number 3, to state that the definition of labor organization shall prevail over any conflicting definition of labor organization in Article 20 of the Colorado Constitution. That was asked and answered, as indicated on page 4 of the transcript, and the fact that this particular question popped up under purposes rather than the comments and questions portion of the memo, I'm not inclined to read comments that narrowly. Second instance, question number 4, under the technical questions, on line 16 for proper citation format, and to indicate that Article 28 is within the Colorado Constitution, would the proponents that consider adding of this Constitution after Article 28? That question was raised and responded to in the transcript by Mr. Gruskin, where he again pointed out the typographical error. And I'd point out that staff In question 3A, under the technical questions, says, with regard to the head note on line 6 of the proposed initiative, the proponents are adding a new section 17 to Article 18 of the Colorado Constitution. And so, to me, rather than 28, which syncs up with the amending clause language that was submitted with the original proposal. So to me, it's not a substantial change for those reasons. I think that's a very interesting argument, a very interesting question, but that's kind of where I'm at on it.
Make a few responses? I'm looking at the case that Mr. Hobbs cited, and specifically the language that he looked at, and there's a preceding sentence that I think is truly controlling. And it says, however, the adoption of language in a subsequent draft of a proposal that substantially alters the intent and meaning of central features of the initial proposal presents a different situation. And then it goes on to characterize it. It says, in that circumstance, the revised document, in effect, constitutes an entirely different proposal from the one previously reviewed by the legislative office. So it's the entirely different proposal is actually a characterization of the test that you use. And I think the test that should be used is, first of all, looking at the language. So I respectfully would disagree with Mr. Carton's position that you don't look at a contextual analysis of what staff may or may not have asked. And certainly, I think everyone agrees that that's a somewhat speculative enterprise. But more directly, that's not how you determine what's substantial and what's not. If they had asked a question that indicates that it's substantial versus not asking a question, I think really what the test is you look at the language. And you say, does the language substantially alter the intent and meaning of one of the central features? And one of the central features here is, in fact, there's only about four features in this whole thing. And one of the central features is dealing with overriding another section of the Constitution. So I think really the test is looking at the language. And the technical versus substantive questions, the paragraph above, it says, one purpose of the public meeting with the legislative offices, as required by the various sections, is to encourage linguistic refinement of drafts. So I think really a technical is a linguistic refinement. You know, maybe someone uses the term alternative instead of alternate. That would be, I think, an appropriate technical change. Or adding a preposition where one should be proper idiomatic approach. So I think to look at substantial, you have to look at the intent and the meaning, whether it alters the intent and the meaning. And I will submit for the board that certainly when I initially looked at that, I was I contacted quite a few clients to explain to them what this thing would mean because it altered Article, well, it defined the current term labor organization in Article 28, which has far-reaching consequences. And I think Mr. Gruskin suggested, said, well, if we don't have this clarification, think about the problem if it doesn't get clarified. Well, the problem is that it hasn't really substantially, substantively, I don't think there's any real difference between those two words, meaning because it affects Article 28 versus Article 18, and there's real consequences to that. The second thing I point out, is it in direct response? Well, I mean, again, I guess I go back to the written language here. The review and comment memo has a section that says comments and questions. These are our comments and these are our questions. And I understand I certainly have a disagreement, respectfully so, with Mr. Carton as to the breadth of that. But to take that reasoning further, someone says, well, is this what it means? No, this isn't what it means. Really what it means is something radically different. And I can say, well, that's now in response to a comment. And with respect to the technical question, Article 28, where it says, would you, and specifically the language says, proper citation format, and to indicate Article 28 was within the Colorado Constitution, would the proponents consider adding of this Constitution after Article 28? Okay? And then he said, and then Mr. Grissom goes on and says, well, as I earlier indicated, we'll make it Article 18, not Article 28. That is not a direct response to the question. There's a reason the word direct is in there, and that is to fairly respond to the question. The question here is, would you consider adding of the Constitution afterwards in order to indicate that we're talking about the Colorado Constitution, or to clarify? So that's, I mean, that was the question. So, I mean, there has to be a meaning to the word direct. That's why the legislature used the word direct here. There has to be meaning to the term comment, question. And when you title a memorandum, when your consideration has gone into comments and questions, I mean, language terms used in the same way, in the same format, in the same structure, should be given the same meaning. And when you have something entitled comment, say, well, no, that's not just the comment. There's stuff that's beyond that. I mean, I think that really violates the plain meaning. Ultimately, what we do here should, if at all possible, and here it's very possible, ground things in the plain language statutes, and ground our analysis in the plain language of the memorandum itself. Probably don't have much more to say, so I'll stop running at the mouth. And
ready to discuss this issue?
If we let's go ahead and just discuss the issue. I think it's a close call. Oh, yes, Mr. Gruskin, go ahead.
I think you're about to walk down a really dangerous path. I really do. I think you're trying to figure out whether or not in a statute that's supposed to be liberally construed to encourage the right of initiative, whether or not comment means comment and question, or whether it includes purpose. Whether or not, I mean, in the 57 decision, one of the technical questions that they cited as the basis for a substantive change that was made was whether or not the right verb tense was used, but the fact is the provision came up. I think that you have an extraordinarily weighty job, because your work product projects the petition signers and voters the issues that they got to decide. This isn't, frankly, of that ilk. I mean, the Supreme Court has been generous in its evaluation of what is and isn't a substantial comment made in response. And I think that you're walking down a path that you really don't want to walk down, because this isn't a statute that's supposed to be narrowly and tightly and strictly construed. You're supposed to be in a position to be able to say, close call, and I think every one of you has said that. Well, you know what? This court recently said in a different case, tie goes to the speaker. And in this instance, that speaker or speakers are the proponents of the initiative. I'm not saying this isn't a legitimate avenue of inquiry, and I'm not saying that you don't have tough calls in this regard, but this to me doesn't seem to be one of them.
Well, and I tend to agree. I think you said it better. In fact, you helped me maybe think through the way I was approaching this, is that I think it is dangerous for us to take an overly technical and narrow view of this. I mean, I'm trying to step back and look at the purpose of review and comment, which someone may correct me, but basically, as I recall, the two purposes are to aid the proponents in arriving at the language that achieves their purpose, and through benefiting from the services of professional drafters. The second is to inform the public about a measure. Here, it sounds like the first purpose was achieved. Out of this, the proponents realized that they had an error in the article that they were referring to. So I don't see that there would be any value right off in returning this to proponents for resubmission for review and comment. I can't quite see that there's a value, and really to skip to both tests, I don't see that right off that there's a value in the proponents returning for review and comment for this particular change. Now, I don't think that's a black and white question, but I agree that there is perhaps a need for us to liberally construe this, look at it in terms of substantial compliance, and try to avoid overly technical constructions that operate as artificial barriers to the initiative process.
The problem is, though, there's a statute that says we don't have jurisdiction to set a title if any substantial amendment is made that's not in direct response to a question unless it's resubmitted. And so I don't think it's easy as just saying, well, construe it liberally and then that's close enough. And I mean, Mr. Carton's comments actually made this harder for me, in that I agree if there had been a lot of questions about how this worked with Amendment 28, then it would be pretty clear that it should go back because the staff was focused on the wrong thing. The problem is, it would be an easier question in favor of Mr. Gruskin if there had been any questions about that indicated that everyone had just been considering this to be Amendment 18, Article 18 all along. And in fact, the memo itself correctly used the sections in the draft, and it wasn't they used 28 when it was appropriate to use 28, and there's no hint in there that they just read it as being 18. And as Mr. Carton's questions pointed out, it really could have a major, if in fact the people voted into the Constitution an amendment that said this definition shall prevail over any other definition of labor organization in Article 28, as I think your questions pointed out, that might really change the law, campaign finance law. And so that makes it harder for me. On the other hand, I do think that the focus, to the extent we have any guidance, the focus is generally internal to the measure, whether it significantly changes one of the purposes of the measure itself rather than it significantly changes something else. And in that sense, this little bit at the end about the definition prevailing over a conflicting definition, which I have another problem with, but it doesn't change the action part of this measure. What the measure is doing is dealing with what employers may or may not require. And so, in that sense, changing what it prevails over is not a substantial amendment to the measure itself, even though it would, I think, if it were in the original language, make a significant difference, or potentially make a significant difference. And to the extent that makes sense, that puts me close enough to the fence to agree that while I don't think it would be, it's an artificial barrier or it's dangerous to enforce the statute as it's written, I do think that that when you've got a word like substantial amendment combined with our instruction to construe the process liberally in favor of the right of initiative, I do think that substantial should be read in such a way that it doesn't, that in a close case like this, the tie goes to the petitioner or whoever we want to call it. So I think on this one, I'm willing to go on.
Let me just ask the board procedurally how you want to handle each of the objections. I mean, we could just wait, and if there is a motion, we could take a motion if someone wants to offer a motion to grant motion for rehearing on this particular issue, or we could just keep going on. I mean, it sounds like no one will offer that motion. I don't think I would second it. I don't think I would make that motion. But and it sounds like Mr. Domenico would not.
No.
But okay, so just procedurally, I'm wondering if you know, if we come to one where someone wants to make a motion, we can. The question then will be, what about the other grounds for the motion for rehearing? But maybe we get to that when it comes up. I raise that because I wonder, you know, what kind of record or what state we want would leave this if there's an appeal. But at this point, maybe I'll just suggest that we go ahead to the other issues that Mr. Gessler has raised, and then if there's some support on the board for changing its prior action, then we consider at that point whether that moots out anything else that Mr. Gessler is raising. Is that okay? Okay. All right. Mr. Gessler, if you want to go on with your other objections.
Thank you, Mr. Hobbs. The next objection talks about the single subject issues. I know there was a fair amount of discussion last time. I think what this this initiative does, and I'll talk about sort of the central features of the motion for rehearing first, and that is it defines what a labor organization is not. Then it says what labor organizations, that employers can't use labor organizations as suspicion labor organizations, condition for employment. But what it also does is it creates new rules of interpretation. And it creates not one, but two new rules of interpretation. The first rule of interpretation is that it says it will supersede or will control over all other definitions within, reportedly, but certainly as this board has decided, Article 18 of the Colorado Constitution. So that's one rule of sort of a conflict of law rule or rule of interpretation. It's not limited, when the use of that word all is not limited to conditions of labor employment or conditions of employment. It says all. It can be any provision. Okay? Any conflicting definition of labor organization in Article 28. So, I mean, you can have definitions of labor organization in Article 28 that purport to conflict with this one, or ones that don't purport to conflict with this one. You can have one definitions in Article 28 of labor organization that deal with employment.
18, right?
I'm sorry, 18. 28 on the mind. You can have definitions of labor organizations in Article 18 that that talk about conditions or related to conditions of labor employment, or ones that aren't related to conditions of labor employment. So any is a different approach and has rules of interpretation for this initiative versus another provision within Article 18, whether or not it has anything to do with labor conditions.
But there aren't any now, right?
That's
there
correct.
Aren't any other definitions.
So right now it's sort of a black hole. And I'd argue, well, I think the court, you know, this, you don't look at, you know, sort of the effects or consequences of it as much as looking at it in terms of what it means. So conceivably, there could never be anything else in Article 18, or there could be a lot of different things in the future in Article 18. Because again, the definition is, or the topic of Article 18 is miscellaneous.
But if somebody wanted to avoid that problem, they wanted to amend the Constitution in such a way to deal with labor organizations, but didn't want to use this definition, couldn't they just stick it in a different article, and then there would be no problem?
Maybe. I don't know. I don't know. But that's a good question, and I think sort of highlights the uncertainty of this. The other point, and this is the one that the board discussed, is that it creates rules of interpretation regarding any other provision adopted at the 2008 election, regardless of the number of votes received by this or any other amendment. And the proponents were forthright, and they said this is a preemptive strike against number four, Amendment 47. I don't think they used the word strike, but they did use the word preemption. And, you know, the intent is to override that. And I think that is clearly a second subject. And certainly, if I remember correctly, Mr. Hobbs agreed with that position. I would like to directly address the recent case, amendment number, regarding proposed initiative number 61. And I think Mr. Domenico had issues with that. This case, the reasoning for this case in the single subject is fundamentally different than the reasoning adopted by the court in amendment, I'll call it, initiative, proposed initiative number 60. And that's why, and I'm confident of that analysis, which is why I passed out the case, so we all have the text in front of us. But what happened in that case is the petitioners, or the objectors, I think it was Corey, basically said, look, initiative 61 does two things. In the first half of Initiative 61, it says X. And in the second half of Initiative 61, it says not X. And those are two inherently conflicting things. And because they're so inherently conflicting and diametrically opposite within the same initiative, then you can't have a single subject. That was their argument. And the court said, no, they're not inherently conflicting within the same initiative. You can have something that says X and then a modification of X. And it's all part of the same subject. And I think that decision and that analysis, I think, essentially received unanimous agreement by all seven justices. That's not the case with this. That's not the case with number 40, with number 123. What number 123 says is, here's X. This is what X does. And now, by the way, we're going to use this to overrule any other initiatives that are outside of this initiative. It's fundamentally different reasoning. Now, I recognize they're similar in the sense that, I would at least characterize, they're sneaky. Okay, I mean, they're similar in that they take an existing initiative, they mimic the language of that, they create an opposite definition of a critical part of a proposed amendment, and create a conflict there. Okay? So they both have that central feature. But as far as the legal analysis as to why number 61 did not meet single subject, it's a much different argument than the one we're making here. And the one we're making here says, look, you can define labor organization how you want or how you not want, because this really doesn't define labor organization. It defines what labor organization is not. Okay? But you can't then go ahead and say this definition will prevail and change the current rules of interpretation for how this conflicts with any other proposed initiative, including the number of votes received. That moves into a separate subject that's not connected to what you call the definition of a labor organization or the conditions of employment. It's not connected with that. Instead, a completely different subject. Now, Mr. Gruskin pointed out that the court has said you can write an initiative like that. And he frankly admitted that that was before the single subject rules. So yeah, you can write, you may be able to write that, but it's still a second subject. And that's exactly what's happening here. So there's really two different subjects that I'm talking about. One that I didn't go into as much detail, the change of any provision in Article 18, whether or not it has to do with labor conditions of labor employment or not. It's broad, sweeping in its scope. Second is the rules of sort of conflict resolution with respect to initiatives that fundamentally change statute and current Supreme Court rulings on how you deconflict, assuming there's a conflict, how you deconflict those initiatives. So those are specifically different subjects. I'm happy to address questions before I go on.
Let me ask you, Mr. Gessler. I still have some issues about this measure's compliance with the single subject requirement, but I'm mostly concerned right now about the impact of the court's decision in number 61. So I appreciate you bringing that up. Putting aside the details of how this measure is drafted, wouldn't you say that this measure really is a lot like number 61 in that if you step back and look at it, What it is saying is that employers can't require membership in any organization as a condition of employment, but there's an exception, and the exception being employers can require membership in a labor organization. I mean, to me, that's kind of what this is saying. It's sort of like 61. There's a general prohibition against discrimination, statement of a general principle. Again, that's not the way it's drafted, but that's the way I'm interpreting it, is that there's a statement of general principle that employers shouldn't require their employees to belong to certain to organizations of any type. And then it makes an exception for labor organizations, unions. And that's like number 61. There's a prohibition against discrimination, and then basically saying, well, there are some forms of what some people might consider preferential treatment or discrimination that will be allowed. It's the same. It's an exception to the general rule. And couldn't I look at this one as very similar to number 61?
That aspect of it, I think you could. I mean, they're both poison pills. They're both poison pill initiatives, as I characterize them. But I think you have to, with respect to the effect of what it does, I think they're similar in the sense that both of them. But they're dissimilar if you look at the analysis that the court employed in 61 versus the resolution in this particular instance. Number 61 basically said, okay, here's the definition of affirmative action, and that sort of says with this exception that basically nullifies the rule. Okay? And I think what the court, I don't know what the court said, but I think one way to interpret the court's opinion is to basically say, look, I mean, you've got two inherently conflicting definitions of affirmative action. And it's up to the people to decide which one they want. Okay? That's what they're doing. That's what the political battle's all about. Okay? And the court, fortunately in my view, but nonetheless, rejected any confusion issues that were raised, those confusion arguments. So the court said, go fight it out. This is a little bit different. This initiative isn't just fight it out. This initiative is, if you fight it out, we're going to win if we pass. Doesn't matter what you do on the other one, we're automatically going to win based on sort of the end purpose here and the way it's resolved. It changes sort of the way the rules of interpretation and how to resolve conflicts between initiatives. So that's, I think, fundamentally different than number 61. And then also ultimately in 61, I mean, you really sort of have to recognize that 61 is, I mean, limited to that particular fact situation as well, in the sense that it said, pull up the exact language here. Court says, if I could just one moment, please. It says here, this will be my next subject, under headnote 4 on page 6, it says, nothing in the second sentence of the initiative constitutes a second subject. Instead, and here's the operative language, the initiative affects one general purpose and thus contains a single subject. And the purpose had to do with affirmative action and how you define that. Here's the difference in this one. This one, it says an employer shall not require as a condition of employment that an employee join or pay dues or assessments or other charges for a labor organization. Then rather than defining what labor organization is, it defines what labor organization is not. It's not. It says it's not this, it's not that, it's not another thing. So rather than being connected, it's purposely disconnected. Rather than being dependent upon, it's purposely independent from. So that's a further violation of the single subject. That also differs from 61. See, Mr. Domenico, sometimes squinting in a skeptical fashion, so I'm happy to answer questions about that. But I don't think I need to believe
that. No, that part of it, that part of your argument I'm struggling to understand. The part of your argument that I brought up last time and I'm still really struggling with is the provision that attempts to override the rules of construction for initiatives. That part has nothing, 61 had nothing to say about that. I mean, I think the court's decision in 61 basically authorizes people to engage in this sort of deceptive, confusing, tricky way of writing initiatives and leave it up to the political process to point that out. And so, given 61, the fact that it took me about 10 readings and sort of a flow chart to understand what was going on here is irrelevant. But I agree with you. 61 says nothing about this attempt not only to change the law of or preempt another initiative about union dues, but it attempts to change the substantive law of constructive of how the court is to interpret and apply initiatives. And 61 doesn't say anything about that, and that's the only aspect of this single subject argument that still troubles me at all. But it troubles me quite a bit, and I wonder if you have any authority for the idea that that this kind of change of a rule of interpretation can't be coupled with a substantive measure.
Certainly, proposed initiative 55. I'm just kidding on that. I think that there is not much authority along those lines. And I know Mr. Gruskin used the example. Well, this is just sort of like the date of implementation. Just like the date of implementation, it's no different. But I think it's much different than that. And I think the strongest argument there is. Now, there's a body of case law and specific statutory statements that are outside of labor conditions, that are outside of Article 18, that basically say, look, this is how we interpret the will of the people. If there's two conflicting provisions, we interpret it, the one that gets the most votes, based on sort of the democratic process and the way the initiative should work. That's an important thing. And to rejigger those rules, when that rejiggering is not necessary to determine what's a labor organization, it's not necessary to determine what's a condition or isn't a condition of labor employment, it's not connected to that, and it's done for admittedly the straight up purpose, I mean, and the proponents admit it, the purpose is to preempt number 47, okay, or preempt any other one that comes up dealing with that. It's the preemption that is certainly, it's a much, much different beast that we're talking here as compared to labor conditions. And it's self-consciously trying to short-circuit the democratic rules of interpretation. So I'll frankly admit that I think that's our strongest single subject argument, but I also think in this instance it is a winner because it's a serious problem. And the reason why I spent so much time on 61 is I thought you had been persuaded that 61 controlled in this instance. Someone did. I think Mr. Domenico, but I may be mistaken.
No.
I can look at, that's why I provided the transcript.
I think it controls, but on the other side,
yeah.
Mr. Hobbs was.
So.
Yeah, that's right.
So anyway, that's best I can answer that question.
Mr. Carton, is that, or Mr. Domenico, or are you, if you wanted to pursue that?
Well, I don't have any more questions. And I don't know if Mr. Gruskin has anything to add to what he said last time. This is one I probably am going to offer a motion on. I don't know if you want to discuss or if Mr. Gruskin wants to.
Well, I think Mr. Carton has a couple of questions,
oh,
Mr. Gessner.
Sorry.
Mr. Gessler, I want to focus on your argument that this preemptive clause is a separate subject, and just ask a couple questions, one or more of which may be loaded, but the first clause of subsection 2 says, as used solely in this article and notwithstanding any other provision of law. Would you agree that the clause, notwithstanding any other provision of law, is one that's commonly found in a variety of statutes, if not perhaps, and I don't know about the Constitution, notwithstanding any other provision of law, have you sometimes seen that in other statutes?
I think I have. Normally what I see, and I'm not trying to weasel out of your assumptions here, but normally I think what I see is notwithstanding any other provision within the subsection, or notwithstanding any provision within this title, where it's very limited along those lines. But I'm sure...
Is it your argument that if the second sentence of subsection 2 was not in the measure, that would directly address your single subject argument, or would remove the argument that you are making that the measure does not contain a single subject?
Yes.
Doesn't the notwithstanding any other provision of law clause really have the same? Here's my loaded question, okay? Doesn't it really have the same effect as the second sentence? From purely a textual standpoint or a drafting standpoint, can the argument be made that this definition shall prevail over any conflicting definition of labor organization, etc., given the language notwithstanding any other provision of law, is legalese, kind of a belt with the suspenders, for this particular provision, it's surplusage, it's more or less a clarification. If the second sentence wasn't included in 123, and both 47, now 47, right, and 123 passed, wouldn't the notwithstanding any other provision of law language make this definition of labor organization the superseding definition?
No. And my point goes back to the ballot initiative that implemented GOCO versus, I believe it was the Tabor provision at that time. And you had two initiatives that internally basically said, notwithstanding anything else out there, this is what must happen. And they were directly conflicting with one another. They were internally consistent, used in a way which is commonly used, and in instances like that, you know, where you see notwithstanding any other provision of law, and maybe you have another section that says notwithstanding, you know, sort of two sections pointing at each other, notwithstanding each section, you know, what a court will say is, well, the more specific governs over the more general, or the more recent governs over the older one. I mean, you have those rules of interpretation that are external to the language and the intent of the initiative itself or the measure itself. So it's an external rule of interpretation. And what the court, I believe, said in those conflicting initiatives is, look, these are irreconcilably conflicting. One says functionally, notwithstanding the other one. We don't care what the other one says, we control. So they were conflicting with one another. So the court said, let us go outside of the language, let us go outside of the intent to come up with rules of interpretation to determine how we're going to resolve this conflict. So the reason I say no is because, and I don't have the language of Amendment 47 in front of me, okay, but I'm assuming that Amendment 47 purports to be comprehensive and controlling. Okay? And so what happens is you've got an irreconcilable conflict, or at least this anticipates that you're going to have an irreconcilable conflict by its interpretation. And the critical issue, and I think the one that I'm really focusing on for purposes of this argument, is the last phrase of the last sentence, regardless of the number of votes received by this or any other such amendment. Because you could include language including any provision adopted at the 2008 general election. And that is meaningless under the current court rules, statutory interpretation. That's meaningless if the other one says the same thing and gets more votes. It's tough. We've got a separate manner in which we interpret these rules. So I accept a few of your premises, but I do not accept the logic because I think there are other controlling factors outside of that that have to be considered.
Can I ask a question that's sort of a follow-up or related to that? I don't have 47 in front of me, but it's occurred to me, and I probably should have looked at it more carefully, is it possible, would it be possible to apply both of these in the sense that, as you've pointed out, what this measure does, what 123 does, it says an employer can't require you to pay dues to these things that we define as a labor organization. And then effectively 47 sort of says you can't be required to pay dues to any of these organizations, labor unions. Why can't you apply both of those in the and basically then nobody has to pay anything to any organization that either fits within 123's definition or 47's definition?
I guess my response to that is perhaps, perhaps not. I think the inquiry, though, is irrelevant, with all due respect. And the reason why is, look, you don't go to the effects of this language. You don't, the effects of this language, you don't compare it to the effects of another one and sort of engage in that type of analysis to determine whether or not there's a single subject. You look at the language of the initiative itself without going beyond that to see how it affects or interplays with other. And truthfully, Amendment 47 is still contingent. We don't know if there's a challenge against it now. We don't even know if it'll ultimately pass. So, I mean, that's sort of a speculative inquiry. And I think you sort of have to stay within the language in front of you here. So, I will, if pressed, I'm happy to take up the invitation to sort of engage in that analysis. But at this point, I would
think that
it's
fine.
Not necessary.
If there are any other questions, perhaps we could hear from Mr. Gruskin.
You got to memorize.
You know, it's a rare day when I'm criticized for being too candid and too deceptive. and so I'm having a little bit of a problem knowing exactly what my identity is. But I think actually I'll veer with the towards the too candid side because. If anything, the point raised by Mr. Carton is exactly right. You have notwithstanding language in one measure. You don't have notwithstanding language in the other. The courts are going to interpret them so that, to the extent they can, they give effect to both. And frankly, with notwithstanding the characterization that this is deceptive, one of the original concerns about 47 is that it has language that says that the organizations affected either conduct certain types of labor, traditional labor management related activities, or any other mutual aid society for employees. The whole point was, at some point, the proponents of 47 were right. You ought not be able to require membership in certain organizations as a condition of employment. And 123 leaves that part of 47 standing. What it doesn't do is negate the history of labor management relations such that there wouldn't also be a condition for union membership in order to go to work for a particular employer. I say we were too candid or too explicit because we didn't rely just on the notwithstanding language. It would have had that legal effect. But we specifically put in there the language that is the source of this particular contention, the fact that it was a triple scoop, if you will, because we used notwithstanding, we used the reference to any other measure except at this election, and at least as to 123, we also put in regardless of votes cast. Now, There is no way that voters won't know the impact of their vote. Had we only used notwithstanding, my guess is they might not have known. But I think in any event, it becomes a non-issue, and it becomes a non-issue for this reason. Of course, presume that voters know the law that they're amending. Therefore, to the extent that we put this on the table, as a condition of this qualification on conditions of employment, in essence, there's nothing deceptive. There's nothing misleading. There's, frankly, been perfect repetitive candor for the voters. There's no question that they'll know what they're voting on. They may or may not accept it. They may or may not like it. But that doesn't mean that they don't know what they're voting on. If they know what they're voting on, then it's not a single subject issue. If the issue is, can you amend this procedure as well as, under subsection 1, impose a restriction on conditions of employment, remember, this is a condition that's directly related to this measure. This isn't, with all appropriate deference, a Doug Bruce measure, where the attempt is to change all procedures relating to all types of ballot measures, not just this one, as well as obtain certain substantive change. So I think that's probably not a real issue. If the concern is that this is deceptive because people won't really understand what it means for one measure to prevail over another, well, the court's already addressed that. The court said it's not misleading. If it's not misleading, I don't see how it can be deceptive. We had the benefit of a conversation at the hearing 2 weeks ago, so I'm not inclined to do anything other than answer your questions if you have
them. Mr. Domenico?
I want to make clear, I don't think that this part of it that we've been discussing is deceptive or confusing at all. The part that I find confusing and deceptive is the beginning, to how you define a labor organization as essentially the opposite, everything other than what people think of as a labor organization, which is what Mr. Hobbs's issue was last time. I think 61, for better or worse, says we can't reject it because of that. So I don't have a problem on this point with deceptiveness, although I should say, while I have such an influential group of people here, that I would beg anyone dealing with legislation to never use the word notwithstanding. It's inherently ambiguous and confusing, and so that's my little request of all these influential people today. The single subject issue I see, though, is that this measure does one thing. It says which sorts of organizations you may or may not be permitted to require employees pay dues to. That's fine. But then it also changes the law of how measures are interpreted, and I don't think that's the same as simply saying, well, this notwithstanding any other provision. This affects giving, if a court were to give effect to that language, it would change this measure and the competing measure. And it could be, there are a number of rules of interpretation that are in statute. I don't think this one's in statute anywhere. I think it's just case law. But that, to me, I don't think matters, that you're changing the substantive rules of interpretation. And it sort of troubles me. I'm not entirely sure it's a single subject issue, but I don't see how a court could actually give effect to that. Partly because if it did, then every measure in the future will have this, and you'll just have a feedback loop and a hall of mirrors where every provision says it applies regardless of the number of votes. I don't see how you could say, well, I mean, what would be the difference between this and one that said, oh, and this measure shall go into effect if it gets 35% of the vote?
How's that
any different than this?
I suppose that both sides get 35% of the vote. You apparently have
there were no competing measure, but someone said, well, we want our measure to go into effect. We don't want to have to do what you normally have to do to win the political battle on this issue. And so say someone came in with their it doesn't matter. No competing measure, and they just added a provision at the end that said, notwithstanding any other provision of the Constitution, this shall go into effect if it gets at least 35% of the vote.
Here's the difference. What number 123 does doesn't fundamentally change the nature of democracy. This rule of interpretation that we seem wedded to is frankly one that if we hadn't put this second sentence in there, I ask you whether or not voters go to the polls knowing that the courts will try to evaluate measures to figure out whether or not there's a conflict. And where there's a conflict, they'll interpret it one way. Whether there's not a conflict, they'll interpret it another way. Having a measure that gets a third of the vote become law is a fundamental change to Article 5, Section 1. And the right of voters to determine through a majority the way their government is structured. And I would suggest to you that there is an essential and pretty critical difference.
But I'm not saying that you're saying that the measure says, like you compared it to changing forever for any measure.
The way democracy works is the presumption of all voters is something has to have at least a majority of support.
I understand that, but the Supreme Court has said the way our initiative, our direct democracy works at least, is when there are conflicting initiatives that pass at the same time, the court has to choose one, and the best way to do that is to pick the one that gets the most votes. I mean, say it was 48 or 55. Say they wanted to say, well, this only goes into effect if it really gets a lot of support of the people for whatever reason. I mean, I don't know that fundamentally changes democracy, but it doesn't seem any different than saying, what law, I mean, democracy has rules about what laws go into effect, what has to happen for a law to go into effect. I mean, so I'm not sure I see the difference between saying 35% and which is the rule in certain cases, and the rule in other cases now is if there are conflicting provisions, the one that gets more votes. That's the fundamental rule of what it is, what you have to do to change certain laws, and you're not only trying to change the law, but change that aspect of how laws are put in place.
Yes, but we're not trying to change the fundamental thing that Amendment 47 does because of subsection 1. If we had only included a definition, then I think you could make your argument. But the point is that the starting presumption that you can change the imposition of conditions of employment is the common boundary between the two measures. The question is, what conditions can you change? And frankly, the ability of voters to say, you know what, this language is simply, you know, I don't mind changing the conditions as to all these amorphous mutual aid societies. And I don't really like the question of unions, which have obviously a different effect. How is that not multiple subjects? My point is, what we've been able to do in this measure is be able to parse that out. And as to the procedural issue of which one takes effect, it seems to me that that's A, part of the political debate, B, but it's part of your title, and C, it's part of the political discussion.
But you just said that the rules about what law takes effect, what you have to do to get a law into the books, is the fundamental question of democracy. The current rule is, if this sentence weren't in there, and this measure got 51%, and 47 got 60%, and they conflict, then the rule is that this measure wouldn't have any effect, that it wouldn't have done what has to be done in order to become law under our democratic system. That's not just procedural. That's the fundamental point of democracy. And that's where, I mean, say a measure said, tried to suspend for itself the single subject rule. How's that different than this? That's not really a fundamental part of democracy. It's more of just kind of a protection, or more like a rule of interpretation, I guess.
Because that's a pre-election issue. You can't suspend a part of the Constitution in a part of the Constitution that hasn't been amended yet that applies to that second part of the Constitution.
But, I mean, that's what I'm saying.
Find me a part of the Constitution that limits our ability to do this. The General Assembly it actually is a statute. The General Assembly has embodied that in order to ease the manner of interpretation.
The Supreme Court has said that you can't put into effect a law, that if you pass a law that conflicts with another one that's in an initiative at the same time, that the one that gets more votes prevails. That's the existing law in Colorado, right?
That is the existing law.
So you're trying to change that law, and you're also trying to change...
Only in the context of this law.
Right. I know, but that's what my hypothetical would only be in the context of that law.
Look, it's probably time for us to get off the head of this pin. You've got a vote to make. I understand that. I don't know that this conversation is really advancing anything. I'm happy to continue to have it. But either fundamentally, you see the restriction that it's limited to this law and that people in your ballot title will be apprised of that, or not. But with all due deference, I'm not trying to cut short this conversation particularly, but I don't know that I'm adding anything to your understanding or appreciation of the measure, and you're simply not, and you're obviously not changing my mind. So I don't know that it's really productive for us to continue to dance this dance.
Fair enough.
Further questions for Mr. Gruskin? Mr. Gessler, do you have any, before I turn to board discussion of the single subject issue, do you have anything else on single subject?
No, I don't.
Okay. Well, discussion by the board then. I'm inclined still to believe that the measure violates the single subject rule. I think it's a really close call. In my own mind, I can articulate it either way. I'm actually not troubled by the part of 123 that changes the, for purposes of just this proposal, changes the statutory provision about when there's a conflict, a measure with the most votes prevails. From single subject point of view, I think that's in furtherance of the purpose of the measure. So I personally don't see a single subject problem with that. And I think I would not see a single subject problem with the measure if all it did was a Trump Amendment 47. And regardless of how it's drafted, I mean, it could be argued that it's surreptitious the way it trumps Amendment, or attempts to trump Amendment 47 by defining labor organization to be anything other than a labor organization. But again, if that's all it did, that's to me still a single subject. And there's nothing as we were discussing yesterday, I think there's no prohibition against surreptitious drafting if that's what this is. It would still be a single subject. Where my difficulty comes in is that the measure goes on to prohibit employers from requiring participation in other organizations other than the Amendment 47 organizations, and the question is that, in my mind, the question is that a separate subject? And I think it probably is. I can argue it the other way, that it is, all the measure is about the subject of, I think, as we expressed it in the title, participation in certain organizations as a condition of employment. And it may very well be that a group of proponents can say that this is a public policy area that they want to speak to, maybe because Amendment 41 raised the issue. And the way they want to speak to this issue is to say that there are some situations where employers should not require employees to be participants in certain organizations, and in other cases where employers could, that's permissible. And looked at from that point of view, maybe this is all one subject. It is troubling to me in trying to figure out if the labor union side of this and the non-labor union side of that are two separate subjects, that they really are. It seems like they really are two inherently different types of situations. And this really kind of goes to the heart of where I'm struggling with it. It's, if this really were about the public policy issue of participation in organizations and when can employers require it, that steers me towards finding single subject compliance. But I'm just having trouble accepting that. That sounds more like public rights and order. And in a nutshell, I'm trying to figure out whether this is more like public rights and order or is it more like number 61. And I'm leaning towards believing it's more like public rights and order, that there, yes, we can define a broad enough subject, conditions of employment, to cover everything in the measure. But the measure really deals with two things that I don't see that are particularly well connected. One is whether Amendment 47 will prohibit employers from requiring union membership or participation, the other being other types of organizations. And those other types of organizations are just so broad and so unrelated to union membership that's why I wonder if that's a separate subject. And I think even, you know, we've talked about credit unions, get well funds, professional organizations. I'm guessing that the Judicial Department could not require judges to be members of the Bar Association or attorneys who work for the Judicial Department to be members of the Bar Association, because I don't think those are labor organizations, that the Bar Association is a labor organization. That all seems quite distinct from the question of whether employers could require participation in a labor organization. And in wrestling with whether or not that's a separate subject or not, whether these are two separate subjects, then I do come back to the surreptitious issue, because again, the Constitution doesn't prohibit surreptitious measures, right? It doesn't prohibit log rolling. The way I read the companion legislation that the General Assembly enacted when it referred the single subject measure to the voters in 1994 was that the General Assembly said they wanted the single subject for initiatives to be interpreted in a way that protects against the same practices that the single subject rule for bills was intended to protect against, such as log rolling and surreptitious measures. When I look at 123 and 124, then it bothers me more that part of it is, I think, surreptitious, because it says that that the part that deals with labor organizations is not what you think. It's defined, because again, it defines labor organization to be something other than a labor organization. And that troubles me as far as trying to resolve, well, that consideration of whether the measure is surreptitious, I think helps me determine whether or not there's a violation of the single subject requirement. I think that's what the General Assembly asked us to do. And if the measure had been drafted differently, then I might feel differently, but that's not the measure before us. What is before us is a measure that prohibits employers from requiring participation in non-labor union organizations, and then trumps, as a second subject, I think, trumps Amendment 41. And I just err on the side of believing, or lean towards believing, that those are two separate subjects, even though I think it's a really close call. In my question earlier to Mr. Gessler, I could see that this could be characterized as falling under Amendment 61. I could also see that it falls under public rights in water. And that's, at this point in the discussion, that's where I am, that it's more like public rights in water, where we are attempting to determine if we can take a, if we can define a broad subject like conditions of employment in order to cover what I think is two essentially unrelated things going on in the measure. So in any event, I think I'm probably where I was before, that I think the measure violates the single subject, both 123 and 124 violate the single subject requirement. Any other discussion by the board? Mr. Carton.
Brief. Going back to the original title board meeting on 123 and 124, I won't restate all of the reasons why I concluded that 123 and 124 contain a single subject. I understand Mr. Hobbs's argument. I think it's refined and as always is well considered. I'm going to respectfully disagree. Going back, it seems to me that what 123 and 124 do is provide that an employer shall not require as a condition of employee employment that an employee join or pay dues, assessments, or other charges to or for a labor organization. Measures then define what a labor organization is, notwithstanding any other provision of law. Further adds a clause specifying or clarifying that is, in my mind, a direct extension of the notwithstanding other provision of law clause, that the definition prevails over any other conflicting definition of labor organization in Article 28 of the Constitution. In that regard, narrowly addresses definitions in that article of the Constitution. And so, with all due respect to Mr. Gessler, I don't, in his argument that this particular, I think as he said it, creating new rules for resolving conflicts between this initiative and other initiatives appearing on the 2008 statewide ballot, Mr. Gessler's argument, his motion for a hearing, that the last sentence of subsection 2 creates new rules for resolving conflicts between the initiative and other initiatives appearing on the 2008 statewide ballot, and that therefore there are multiple subjects. Again, for the reasons I've stated, I think that that sentence is part and parcel of the measure. It is a unique provision. but I don't think that it amounts. I guess what I would say is I'd reiterate Mr. Hobbs's arguments as far as he stated that that particular clause did not, in his mind, raise a single subject problem. And I'll stop there. I guess to sum up, again, the reason I don't think it's two subjects and why I believe that the current title for the measure accurately contains single subject of the measure is because it's a prohibition on conditions of employment, on membership in a non-union type of group. In my mind, it's I would deny the motion for rehearing on the single subject argument.
Mr. Domenico.
Well, I agree with Mr. Carton on the sort of heart of the matter that, and therefore disagree with Mr. Hobbs's reasoning, because I do see this as essentially, that part of it at least, all as dealing with conditions, what employers can and can't require people to, what kind of organizations people can and can't require their employees to join. Basically, it's the same subject, I think, as 47, just takes a very different approach. And the part that troubled me with that was that it's written in such a confusing way, but I think that under 61 doesn't amount to a single subject problem. My problem really is with the last sentence, which I don't think is comparable to simply saying notwithstanding any other provision of law, which is hardly unique, is very common, and is essentially required in a lot of drafting. To make clear, it's basically a shortcut to having to say, lay out exactly how a law interacts with existing law. That, to me, is very different than what this last sentence does. It's not at all a belt and suspenders. The last sentence does something that you couldn't do in any other way. It's, to me, no different than saying this measure shall take effect if it gets 45% of the vote, and it's no different than saying this measure shall, the single subject requirement shall not apply to this measure. And whether you characterize a 40% majority or a 50% majority or a 60% majority as the fundamental requirement of democracy, and you can't change that, but you can change this requirement for how initiatives become law, because it's somehow less fundamental, is doesn't resolve the single subject problem for me. I mean, this measure tries to make a substantive change in the in what employers and employees, the relationship between employers and employees, which is fine, but it also tries to make a substantive change in how an initiative becomes law. And there's no, that to me is a second subject. If this is allowed, every measure will have something like this in it if it's got a chance of having a conflicting measure, and you'll end up with a mess. But while that doesn't really answer the question, it does bring up why this is a problem, that essentially if by coming in last and including this sort of thing, they get around some of the typical rules, that's not really a problem, but it does, single subject problem, but it does point out a problem for the initiative process. And to me, a measure can't exempt itself from the rules. That is a single subject. If you want to change the rules about how an initiative becomes a law, then I think you have to change the rules. And, of course, it, as Mr. Hobbs said, it advances the purpose of the measure, but so would a 40% requirement advance it. And to me, suspending the rules of how a measure, what a measure has to do to become a law, even if it only applies to that measure, is still a separate subject. And it's not necessary to anything else. All it does is says our opponents, whatever they do doesn't matter as long as we get 50% plus one. And that is changing not just this measure, but changing what another measure would normally have to do. And that, to me, is a single subject, or is a separate subject. This obviously isn't necessary to the measure, whereas I do think in some cases the notwithstanding language could be necessary to make clear what's going on. This is not the least bit necessary to accomplishing the goals, except in the sense of exempting the measure from the typical rules. And so I'm afraid I think that's a single subject, or a separate subject from the other substantive subject of employer-employee relationship. So for different reasons, I guess I'm in agreement with Mr. Hobbs.
So it would be potentially possible for the board to adopt a motion to find that the measure violates single subject, but for quite different reasons. I mean, Mr. Domenico and I really disagree on that last point, but and it actually bothers me a little bit to end up with that result, but that's the way it is. So, Mr. Carton.
I just wanted to clarify, Mr. Domenico, does that reasoning apply to number 124 as well?
Yes, I think it does, even though that last sentence is slightly different in 124.
Because you don't have the land.
To the extent that sentence is meant to have any effect, I think it can only really be interpreted to be intended to have the same effect, which is to exempt itself from the typical rules of interpretation. I mean, if the last sentence ended itself after Article 18, I might be okay with it and agree that it's simply a boots and suspenders type of thing. But if that sentence is meant to have any effect, it's meant to say that Supreme Court, if we get 50% plus one, and it doesn't matter what else anybody else does, which changes the rules of how initiatives become law, which is the second subject that I see.
And although I won't change Mr. Domenico's mind, I think I want to respond for the record on one thing that you said. I think if this measure said that if either of these measures said that 40% constitutes passage of this measure, I would not find a problem with that on single subject grounds. Again, I think that would fit right well within the subject and the purpose of the proponents. I personally think it would be ineffective, but although we wouldn't have to resolve
that. How could it be ineffective?
Because the measure, that provision would never take effect because the rules in place right now are that the rules that would be applied to determine if that takes effect is whether or not a majority of the voters passed it. And if a majority of the voters don't pass it, that would never be effective.
So does that analysis, do you think, apply to this in the sense that if they get fewer votes that it won't go into effect?
No, because I think once, if this measure, say 123 or 124, received a majority of the votes, it would go into effect. Now, then at least purportedly it would trump Amendment 47, regardless of the number of votes that Amendment 47 got, that this measure would be in effect. I don't know for sure whether it would work. I'm just saying at least the difference is that the voters would have approved a measure that says that it trumps a measure that gets more votes. But that wouldn't be the case if the measure said 40%, because the measure would never take effect. I'm not sure about, I mean, there are other scenarios we discussed about single subject and so forth I'm not sure of. But my point being that all of those things, in my mind, are they're problems, but they're not single subject problems, because they're ways that proponents might think of how they can advance their cause and ensure that they get the result they want.
Well, I just find that pretty remarkable that that's all that is required by this, that as long as it advances their cause, that the single subject rule isn't implicated. Changing the rules of how something becomes a law is an incredibly, as Mr. Gruskin pointed out, fundamental aspect of democracy. And to say that just because changing a fundamental aspect of democracy also advances your cause of getting your provision into law is therefore not a different subject is really remarkable to me.
My last comment, Mr. Chair, is that I know this isn't going to change anybody's mind, but I do think we do need to be mindful of 140.106.52, and as the court has recently pointed out, if not reminded, that the title board must construe the single subject requirement liberally so as not to impose undue restrictions on the initiative process. As always, I understand and respect the arguments of my colleagues here, but I think one could reasonably conclude, based on the arguments here today and the text of the measure, that 123 and 124 contain a single subject.
I guess I'll offer a motion that the board grant the motion to the extent that the measures 123 and 124 violate the single subject rule. And in offering a motion, I'm also trying to figure out whether, if there's support for that, whether we would want to deal with the other objections in the motions for rehearing, which we have not yet dealt with, which I think are objections to the titles themselves. If the board were to find that the measures violate the single subject requirement, the titles become moot. I don't see anything wrong with the board going ahead and dealing with those if we wanted to. But I guess at this point I'm suggesting that maybe the right motion would be just that the board decline to set titles on the basis of violation of single subject and grant the motions for rehearing to that extent.
I second the motion.
Then I guess if that motion is adopted, we'll leave it up to the board as to whether or not there's any further action that it wants to take. Is there any further discussion on the motion then? If not, all those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
All those opposed, no.
Nope.
That motion carries 2-1. Any further action then? We have not discussed the other grounds raised in the motions for rehearing that relate to the titles. In general, I think, although we haven't had the benefit of the discussion on the objections to the titles, I'm not personally inclined to go forward with discussion on those issues. I think the titles are sufficient. I don't necessarily, though, want to preclude discussion that might be helpful in an appeal or whatever. So I'll leave it up to the board if you want to move forward and consider the motions for rehearing with respect to the titles. Mr. Kaiser.
Can I just bring up one matter? In 61, if I recall correctly, the board reversed itself on the single subject issue and decided that it wasn't a single subject. It did not then consider, if I'm recalling correctly, some of the changes to the substance of the titles or to the content of the titles. The court then reversed the board on the single subject issue and then went on to consider whether or not the titles were sufficient, even though the board did not consider the suggested changes to the title. So I'm wondering, just suggesting to the board that they may want to consider the possibility of looking to the request to amend the title, considering the possibility that the Supreme Court may reverse. That is within the board's discretion.
And just to clarify then, even though the board had not considered the objections to the titles, the court considered the objections to the titles, although I think the court rejected those objections.
Correct. The board, the court looked at the titles that were originally set by the board, even though the board had not reviewed the objections raised by the protester.
And the court took into consideration that the titles perhaps should be amended based on the other objections.
Correct.
But declined to make any changes.
Correct.
So here, we could either further amend the titles or we could leave it as it, we left it in number 61. Sorry, we could either amend the titles if we want to, or we could leave it as we did with number 61, which would still allow objectors to raise issues with respect to the sufficiency of the titles themselves.
That's correct.
Here's the difficult position that the Supreme Court has left us in. If we don't move on to try to write the title, then the Supreme Court will, if they overturn us on an appeal, the Supreme Court will consider the objections, but I think only applying their typically deferential standard of review, which is essentially to say, well, is this a permissible one, and they won't do what we normally do, which is try to improve it in any way we can. And so that, if we don't amend the titles at all, we may not have written the best title that we could, and in 61, presuming that that goes forward, a title that we didn't really consider all the objections to is what will be on the ballot. On the other hand, if we do try to change the title, I'm not sure how we do that. Do Mr. Hobbs and I try to change it in such a way that it reflects our concerns? I mean, do I insist on putting some statement up front about changing the rules of what becomes an initiative? Does Mr. Hobbs try to change it? Do we pretend that we were wrong and that Mr. Carton's interpretation is right? It's a little difficult.
Mr. Gruskin.
Maybe I can, not that this isn't a fascinating conversation, but maybe I can cut short the conversation a little bit. In 61, as in previous cases, where the court decided that you incorrectly refused to set the title, it went ahead and set the title. In 61, it said, where the reversal requires the board to set or amend the title, we give the board specific instructions as to the wording of the title. Accordingly, we must remand 61 to the board and articulate the title to be set. So, I mean, I'm sure that you're enthralled, and there's probably some sense of kumbaya thing. It's the end of the cycle. This is the last measure. And do you really want to say goodbye to each other over this? But if that's not the case, well, I think the court will evaluate any sort of concerns with the title and impose certain requirements as to whatever title. Now, I'm not really not trying to cut short your process, but I just think it's important for you to have as part of your conversation that the court won't just defer to the title you already set, but will consider anything the objectors would say in their brief as to the sufficiency of the title.
Well, and I think the point's well taken. It follows up on what Mr. Domenico is saying. It's a little hard, I think, for us to know what to do with the titles without knowing what the court's view of the single subject arguments might be, and that we might be spinning our wheels a bit trying to figure out what a title would be if the court were to find no violation of single subject. So on the one hand, I want to be fair to Mr. Gessler and provide an opportunity, but at this point, I guess I don't see much merit in trying to improve the titles without knowing the court's view on the disparate single subject objections. Mr. Gessler, do you have any contrary view if we... I mean, it sounds to me like you could still make your objections to the titles, but...
Well, the objections are part of the record, and if this goes forward on appeal, we'll certainly phrase that. I guess in part I'm also looking at Article 5, Section 1, Subsection 5.5, where it says, if a measure contains more than one subject such that a ballot title cannot be fixed that clearly expresses a single subject, no title shall be set, and the measure shall not be submitted to the people for adoption or rejection of the polls. I mean, that is some plain language there. On the other hand, I sense that we have a bit of one for us, and I'm not strongly inclined to argue one way or the other.
Okay. Well, unless there's a motion, then I don't think any further action is required. So, hearing no other motions, then that concludes action on number 123 and number 124. The time is 11 o'clock. I do want to note that we may need a meeting on June 4th, the first Wednesday in June. I think the remand in number 61, the mandate may take effect sometime after today, but we may need to act on number 61 on June 4th. If that's the case, there would be what I would think would be a very brief meeting. I cannot be present because I'll be at a clerk's conference out of town. So it may be that I will be looking for finding the other two board members, looking at their schedules, and hopefully there would be a time where the other two board members could. I think that was Ms. Eubanks and Mr. Domenico on number 61.
Yeah.
So I would contemplate having a meeting sometime on June 4th. With that, then I think that concludes our agenda, and we are adjourned. Thank you.